What makes a good science fiction movie is that lots of special effects and eyeball kicks and explosions and cute alien chicks with three breasts, slightly effeminate robots that don't threaten the masculinity of the main human characters, spaceships that go whoosh in a total vacuum, and other really dumb bits of science fiction Hollywood business? No. And we're going to talk about that soon. Welcome to Paleo Cinema. Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema number 35. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm going to be talking about science fiction movies. I know a fair bit about science fiction movies because I've been watching them for a very long time. I've read endless books about them. I've read endless magazines about them, and I've talked to friends about them ad nauseum. I'm going to get into that in a little bit. I'll get Sal to do the intro. I'll let you update you on what's happening around here. And we'll kick ass and take names and get this podcast underway.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Hey, movie buffs. So what's been happening around here today? I made a big mistake. I loaded the release candidate for Windows 7 onto the laptop, and it fucked up a number of things. I've spent the last 6 or 7 hours trying to troubleshoot the computer, get it up and running, get something that will connect with the microphone going on the system. I'm actually using the old microphone, not the beautiful blue snowball, for this particular podcast. So if the sound quality isn't as good as it normally is or is a bit different, that's the reason why I'm back on the older technology, which is fair enough. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I've got two different microphones. But apart from that, things are going fine. Sal's doing well. I'm doing well. It's starting to turn towards springtime a little bit. And according to everybody, the global crisis is almost over, which is a bit marvellous. So I hope everyone out there is doing fine and that you're weathering the storms of the 21st century really well. But this time around, we're talking about science fiction. I did do that enormous info dump on you a number of podcasts ago where I did a science fiction extravaganza, name-checking every science fiction movie I liked between 1895 and 1980. I did get feedback saying that that was too much of an info dump, so I thought I'd drill down a little bit, talk about maybe 3 or 4 science fiction movies this time and look at what works and what doesn't work in science fiction as film. Now, I do know a little bit about this. I've been a science fiction fan for about 30 years at least. I've been going to conventions. I've spoken with a number of people. I've been on panels with movie producers and science fiction writers. And now and then you pick up little bits of business that ultimately lead you to realize that, yes, you know a little bit about it and you can tell shit from Black Forest Gâteau. So what makes a good science fiction movie? I'm not going to answer that one immediately. I'm going to kind of lead you towards it. First off, I'll talk about a film that doesn't really work. It should work, but ultimately there are some disappointing aspects to it, which I think are artifacts of the time and place in which it was made. So first film we're going to look at is The Day the Earth Stood Still, not the hideous, monstrous abortion of a remake done last year starring Keanu Reeves and John Cleese as Albert Einstein, but the 1951 version directed by Robert Wise starring Michael Rennie and Patricia Neal and a very unsung guy called Locke Martin, who was about 7 foot tall and was a nightclub greeter in a nightclub in Hollywood. He played Gort. He was the guy inside that silvered rubber suit, sweating like a pig to make one of the best and most monstrous robots in science fiction cinema. So all credit to Locke Martin. We should name check him because the poor bastard suffered for our enjoyment. I'll just briefly go over the story. We pretty much all know it, but there may be people who don't. One sunny summer day in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s, a flying saucer lands in a park and a man gets out of it, and also with him a giant silver robot called Gort. The man attempts to wield what some people take for a weapon, and he's wounded by a trigger-happy soldier, and of course the soldiers have surrounded the UFO as they would in that circumstance, and he's taken to hospital. The man's name is Klaatu, and he represents an interplanetary federation who are pissed off with the human race for doing nuclear testing and who have come to dissuade us from doing so and potentially threatening their planets in the future. Now, of course, this is all a bit of a Christ allegory. Klaatu comes down from the heavens and he has a message of peace. When he travels incognito among the human race, he uses the name of Mr. Carpenter, which, of course, is the occupation of Jesus Christ when he was in Civvy Street. We all know it, and it is a good science fiction film. It's intelligent, it's well made, the acting is great, and the creation of Gort, the robot with unnamed energies brimming through his visor before he zaps things and disintegrates them, is one of the iconic images from 1950s science fiction cinema. And I like the film a lot. I am very, very fond of it. But I've got a couple of issues with the plot. Looking at it recently, I had a few what-the-fuck moments while watching The Day the Earth Stood Still, and I'll just do another little sound clip from it, and then we'll have a bit of a talk about what confounded me with this film.
I am leaving soon, and you will forgive me if I speak bluntly. The universe grows smaller every day, and the threat of aggression by any group, anywhere, can no longer be tolerated. There must be security for all, or no one is secure. Now, this does not mean giving up any freedom, except the freedom to act irresponsibly. Your ancestors knew this when they made laws to govern themselves and hired policemen to enforce them. We of the other planets have long accepted this principle. We have an organization for the mutual protection of all planets and for the complete elimination of aggression. The test of any such higher authority is, of course, the police force that supports it. For our policemen, we created a race of robots. Their function is to patrol the planets in spaceships like this one and preserve the peace. In matters of aggression, we have given them absolute power over us. This power cannot be revoked. At the first sign of violence, they act automatically against the aggressor. The penalty for provoking their action is too terrible to risk. The result is we live in peace, without arms or armies, secure in the knowledge that we are free from aggression and war, free to pursue more profitable enterprises. We do not pretend to have achieved perfection, but we do have a system. And it works. I came here to give you these facts. It is no concern of ours how you run your own planet. But if you threaten to extend your violence, this earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder. Your choice is simple. Join us, and live in peace, or pursue your present course and face obliteration. We shall be waiting for your answer. The decision rests with you.
So let me get this straight. Either we let a bunch of robots tell us whom we can and we can't take arms against, or the whole planet gets destroyed? That's hardly fair. I mean, if you got one dickhead, just say you've got a Kim Jong-il, who decides to make war, they destroy all of the Earth. Not a smart thing. It's a bit too arbitrary for my taste, and it's incredibly fascistic. If you go back to the original story, Farewell to the Master by Harry Bates, you'll find out where this kind of theme comes from. The problem is, in the story, right at the end, the punchline is that the robots are the masters and the human beings are the servants when Klaatu comes to Earth. So, ultimately, this story is about a robot takeover. It's like the singularity of Werner Vinge. The robots have taken over and the human race doesn't really have any viable choice on its future. It's a point of singularity in this film. A sequel would be interesting to see, just the choices made and what follows from those choices. And if indeed whether they can get all of the warring nations of the 1950s to agree to lay down their arms and not act aggressively. Even though The Day the Earth Stood Still is a widely respected film, and rightly so, there are a lot of things there. They were talking about the threat of nuclear annihilation and saying there's a bad thing and looking for a very off-the-wall kind of solution to it. But in spite of that, there's a very dark undertone to the film, which isn't all that common in a large-budget studio film of the 1950s. The nuances and the subtext are quite dark and horrifying, and in a sense it's a very dystopian sort of movie. Yes, we can have a utopian lifestyle without threat of war and things like that, but the costs are very high, and the whole planet gets destroyed if one guy with a whole bunch of C4 struck to his chest attacks one of the robots. I mean, not really fair and not really nice. So that's just my thoughts on The Day the Earth Stood Still. I do like the film, but it's not quite the film that a lot of people think it is. Now we move on to 1940. I'm jumping around a little bit here, but bear with me on this. And a really fun, intelligent and well-made science fiction film by Ernest Schroedersack, who also made King Kong in 1933. The film was Dr. Cyclops, about Dr. Thorkell, a scientist working in the jungles of Peru, who discovers a way of channeling radiation in order to shrink living beings down to the size of small dolls.
Come, my little friends, there's nothing here to alarm you. Vocal cords quite unimpaired. It's a very good sign. Have you no temperature? Dr. Bullfinch, would you be good enough to take the pulse of your companions? As with all little creatures, the first instinct is for escape. Well, there's the stairway. Run if you like.
This film's pretty good. One of the things I noticed when I saw it, was how great the Technicolor is. It's just, it pops. The prints are really clean and clear. The Technicolor is used very well, and there's a beautiful, eerie, green, sickly glow to the radiation used in the movie, which adds to the spookiness of the film. It's got one of those early Technicolor processes that doesn't quite look like anything since then. I mean, I know Gone with the Wind used Technicolor as well around the same time, but I think that Dr. Cyclops, the Technicolor is used beautifully. And the other thing is that the effect shots are really very effective. A lot of them were done with mattes and other trickery of the time, but you don't see matte lines around things. The special effects were used very carefully, so that there was no problem with a disjunction between the small things and the large things. And the sets themselves are pretty spectacular. The oversized sets used when the people are shrunken down are incredibly effective as well. Apparently, they were using slide rules and doing measurements to make sure all the proportions for everything were right. And the filmmakers took extra care in the way they did that. They didn't let okay be good enough. They really went for excellence in this. And that's one of the interesting things that makes a good science fiction film. I'm going to start to talk about that now. There are a number of different aspects that make a good, solid science fiction film. They're not special effects, and they're not explosions, and they're not anything that George Lucas ever did. They're subtle things, and they're things that tickle the mind rather than the eye. Things like a really good script and imagination and ways of filmmakers thinking about what they're going to do in such a way that it's imaginative and it's not quite what would be expected. It's a little off to one side of what would be expected, and in that way it engages the audience so that they become a part of the game. They really get into it. I think one of the problems with a lot of CG movies is that it's used wall-to-wall. If you have a look at something like, well, I'll go back to one of my bugbears, the Transformers films. They're wall-to-wall CG, and you're just left with the effect of being a bug on the grill of one of two cars that's having a collision. They use it close up, and you can't tell what's happening. But everywhere in a movie like Dr. Cyclops, there's a purpose to every action. And one of the other things, I've got to mention this, one of the other things is that the main female character in Dr. Cyclops is a very straightforward, upright, independent woman. She's not the usual screaming chick sort of character that, unfortunately, even Fay Wray in King Kong, she's not a screaming person. She's an intelligent, independent woman. Of course, there's a bit of a love interest thing going there, but in general, she's shown as a person. And I like that. I do like the fact, too, that they thought through a few of the premises, like in order to kill the miniaturized people, Dr. Cyclops sets fire to the long grass they're hiding in. And of course, they outsmart him because he's thinking of them as small animals, but what they really are is small, intelligent beings who will think their way through a problem and find a solution to a problem in a way that his previous experimental creatures, the animals that he killed en masse while doing his miniaturization experiments, would never do. So there's some nice bits and pieces in there too where he underestimates them almost all the way through the film until the point where they trap him and ultimately kill him in order to save their own lives. It's just a fun film. And one of the other things, too, is that steampunk's very big at the moment. And the look of all the lab equipment and the great big radiation suit that Dr. Cyclops wears and the great big levers he throws in order to make the radiation go and the piece of machinery he lowers down a well to gather the radiation, they've all got this great Depression-era technology look that I really like and I think really adds to the vibe of the film. It makes it, from our viewpoint in the 21st century, a very cool movie to watch for that reason. It's a bit like the machinery in Frankenstein. All of those wonderful Van de Graaff generators and things like that, they really add to the mood. So if you get a chance to see Dr. Cyclops, please do. I know you can get it from the usual suspects if you're not able to pay for it, but picking up the DVD would be well worthwhile as well. It's one of those films that's good enough that just having it and perhaps an AVI download of it isn't good enough. You really need to kind of go and get the good quality stuff and maybe see if there are a few extras there. I haven't actually looked at the DVD yet, but it's on my short list of DVDs to pick up. So Dr. Cyclops, definitely recommend it now. And what I'm going to do ongoing during the podcast in future is I'm going to now and then look at science fiction films like this. Because, in a sense, in cinema, science fiction was my first love. And I really haven't done too much about it recently, and I really am enjoying getting back into it. So I'll just take another little break and I'll come back and talk about probably the best science fiction movie of the 1950s and one which has had an influence all the way down to the modern era.
But now, Dr. Moebius, prepare your minds for a new scale of physical scientific values, gentlemen. Twenty miles. Listen. Circuits opening and closing, and they never rest. This is one of their ventilator shafts. You can feel the warm air rising. Look down here. Look down, gentlemen. Are you afraid? Levels. And 400 other shafts, like this one. I'll show you a section of one of the power units. These units are sunk in the body of the planet, 50 miles right below our feet. Now, be sure and look only in the mirror. Man does not behold the face of the Gorgon and live.
Yep, it's Forbidden Planet, the best science fiction movie of the 1950s, as I said earlier. What do I like about Forbidden Planet? Well, there are a number of things to like about it. For a start, the source material was exceptional. In this case, it was based on Shakespeare's The Tempest. So if you're going to borrow, you've got to borrow from the best. And, of course, Shakespeare is the best. Of course, while we're on the subject of Shakespeare, it's really good to remember that this isn't the first Hollywood adaptation of The Tempest in another genre. Yep, there was one before this one. It was done as a Western in 1948, a movie called Yellow Sky, which I haven't watched yet, but it is on the way. It's slowly creeping one bite at a time from a torrent site, and I will look forward to seeing it. Oddly enough, it was made subsequently. The Yellow Sky was remade as The Jackals in about 1968. It was a kind of weird Western filmed in South Africa, where the Prospero character is played by Vincent Price. I do have that copy of that, but I haven't watched it. I'm going to have to watch it now that I've found out that it's actually based on The Tempest. So a little bit of research does some good to help me find interesting things to watch. So Forbidden Planet, I mean, let's face it, without Forbidden Planet, you wouldn't have Star Trek, you wouldn't have Babylon 5, you probably wouldn't have Battlestar Galactica. It's the space opera. It's the original text in a weird kind of way. Yes, it borrowed from a lot of science fiction novels and science fiction magazines, but I think it did it very well, and the story is very interesting. So I'll just do the précis from Wikipedia, and then I'll go in to talk a little bit more about it and why it works so well as science fiction and why it can teach lessons to people making contemporary science fiction movies. Forbidden Planet was a 1956 Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer film. It was filmed in CinemaScope and Metrocolor. And the plot, in the early 23rd century, the United Planets cruiser C-57D is sent to the planet Altair-4, 16 light-years from Earth, to investigate the disappearance of a colonial expedition sent 20 years earlier. Before landing, the ship is contacted by Dr. Edward Morbius, Walter Pigeon, who warns them to stay away. Upon landing, the ship is met by Robbie the Robot, who takes command of J.J. Adams, Leslie Nielsen, Lieutenant Jerry Farman, Jack Kelly, and Lieutenant Doc Ostro, Warren Stevens, to Morbius' house. Morbius explains to them that an unknown force killed all the other members of his crew and destroyed their starship. Only Morbius, his wife, who later died of natural causes, and his daughter, Altera, and Francis, now 19 years old, survived. He fears that the crew of the C-57D will suffer the same fate. Altera has never met a man beside her father and is interested in getting to know the new arrivals and learn about human relations. We won't go any further than that. You pretty much know it. On to why it's so good. For a start, I think that MGM took a big chance with Forbidden Planet. They didn't really have a track record of making large-budget science fiction movies. I'm not sure who or how they convinced the studio to do it, but the script went through a number of revisions before it came to its final form. It was originally going to be set on Mercury. The scriptwriters, Irving Bloch and Alan Adler, titled the original screen treatment in 1952, so it took them a few years to get this thing going, Fatal Planet. They were going to set it in the year 1976 on the planet Mercury. An expedition headed by John Grant is sent to the planet to retrieve Dr. Adams and his daughter, Dorianne, who have been stranded there for 20 years. The plot is roughly the same as the final film, though Grant is able to rescue both Adams and his daughter and escape the invisible monster stalking them. Kind of glad they didn't go with that version, because by 1976, Forbidden Planet would have been dated. People would be going around saying, hey, where's Robbie the Robot? But the sets, and in particular, were quite impressive as well. They made a full-size mock-up of three-quarters of the flying saucer. And by the way, this is the first big movie where human beings were the aliens in the flying saucers and not the other way around. It was a full width, which was 51 metres across. They surrounded it by a huge painted diorama of the desert landscape. And the set took up all the space in a Culver City soundstage, so it was quite a big and quite an expensive film. They reused a lot of the sets and things in some Twilight Zone episodes and a few other bits and pieces that were also filmed at MGM. Robbie the Robot cost them $125,000 to make, and everything they made within the dune buggy thing that he's with and all of that was built especially for the film. So, yeah, and the look of the film is lush. I mean, Morbius's house, the Krell Laboratories with all those great big arcing electrical arcs and immense noises and just the sheer size of it, they're all great eye candy. And they're eye candy with a purpose too. They give you the sense of the place. They give you the sense that this is a strange planet where underneath the ground, machines 20 miles wide are doing things that nobody can even understand. So there's a bit of an intellectual kick to that as well as an eyeball kick. And the electronic music by Lewis and B.B. Baron is fantastic. It's not really music at all. It's just tonalities. They found a book by Norbert Wiener called Cybernetics or Control and Communication in the Animal and the Machine. And they constructed electronic circuits to play music based on equations in a science book. So all those noises were actually scientific equations that were given voice in a weird sort of way. And it definitely adds to the strangeness of the film. A lot of films at the time were using theremin music, but this music is just beyond that, and it gives such a terrific feel to Forbidden Planet. Even when there's not much going on the screen, I'll play a little more of the music from that because it just is quite impressive and quite revolutionary at the time it was made. Arguably, that's some of the strangest soundscape that you're going to get in a science fiction movie, even to this day. So let's bring it all together. Why is Forbidden Planet so good? I mean, they use pretty much stock standard contract players from MGM Studios, Leslie Nielsen, Anne Francis, Walter Pidgeon, Warren Stevens, Jack Kelly, Earl Holliman. The actors themselves did their roles well, but they weren't particularly the the box office stars who might have made the movie into a star vehicle. What they were good, solid actors. So you've got good, solid actors. You've got an imaginative script which adapts a classic work, which itself was an adaptation of previous works. The Tempest isn't a standalone. Shakespeare thought it all up. It was done in the style of the Commedia dell'arte. It used tropes and tricks and bits and pieces from previous works. So there's a long history leading down to Forbidden Planet of a plot line and a storyline that works. So you've got that. You've got really dedicated technicians. I mean, the people who made the work, from the set designers and the barons who did the musical, if it is music, to Joshua Meador, who was a Disney animator who made the visualizations of the Id monster. All of these people had one thing in common, which really makes a difference between good science fiction film and a science fiction film that's all eye candy, no guts. They treated their original source material with respect, and I think that made so much of a difference. They gave their best to it. They thought through their premise. They let their imaginations play. They really did respect the material. Too often in modern science fiction films, and you can roll off the tongue the name of 15 films that do this, the story serves the visuals rather than the visuals serving the story. And I think that's always a big mistake. It'll work for a little while, but ultimately it becomes eye candy and nothing more than eye candy. It becomes something that engages the eye without engaging the mind. And I kind of like to have a film that does both. I think science fiction is great when it shows you things you've never seen before, but it also makes you think of things you've never thought before. That's one of the reasons why a film, say, like Solaris is a much better film than 2001 A Space Odyssey. There's an emotional heart to Solaris, the dead wife being resurrected, all those sorts of things. Whereas a film like 2001 is all eye candy. And it's probably the first big science fiction movie that was that. I mean, any film where you've got to get off your tits to really enjoy it, it's probably a film that you shouldn't see in a cinema and maybe you should not give your money to. Good science fiction engages the mind as well as the eyes. And sometimes it doesn't even have to engage the eyes. It just has to engage the mind. And I believe that Forbidden Planet is definitely a film that does that. There are a number of other films as well, a number of other science fiction films that are really rich in things for our brains. I mean, we've talked about a number of them on the podcast, films like Village of the Damned and The Damned, Joseph Losey's The Damned. Even a small, microscopic budget film like from one of the very early podcasts that talked about Creation of the Humanoids. They give you ideas. They give you value when you step out of the cinema and you have more to think about and you're thinking through the implications and the ramifications of what you've seen. You don't get that with something like Transformers, where, yep, the giant robots transform and there are cute bits and one of the robots pisses on something and that's about it. It's intellectually empty stuff. This film doesn't have to be. It takes a little more effort to make it worth thinking about after the film in a non-derogatory way. So I'm just going to take another break. I'm actually going to do a music break. I decided to change the mood a little bit because I've been gabbing on about films and acting very seriously. Going to give you a little bit of Light Mel Torme. It's actually a song that was in a movie. The title of the movie is the same title as the song. I haven't seen the movie. It's from the 1940s, but I like the song. Silly and campy, and it's totally out of place in a science fiction podcast. So that's why I'm going to play it for you. It's called Six Lessons from Madame Lazonga.
Have you ever been embarrassed when you're in a smart cafe, when they play that Latin tempo? Is your dancing quite passe? There's a studio on Main Street over Tony's clothing store where a very small investment pays you dividends galore. Six lessons from Madame Lazanga, and you'll be known from Maine to Cucamonga. Six lessons, and Madame will slick up your cha-cha and mambo, including the hiccup. Her four Latin daughters will help you to start, while finding the rhythm you might lose your heart. Six lessons from Madame Lazanga, and you'll discover what practice can do. She'll give you the beat, give you two brand new feet. It's bound to bring out the Latin in you. Rosita gives you lesson one, Chiquita gives you lesson two. Madam's there to supervise every step and exercise. The madam shows you how to walk, the madam marks it with a chalk. When the madam starts to squawk, that's her Latin double talk. Lessons from that gal Lazanga will positively do wonders for you. Get hip, get real cool, start your own dancing school. It's bound to bring out the Latin in you.
Not going to hear that in any other podcast, are you? On to the letters now. I've got a few of them. And by the way, remember last podcast I spoke about wanting to get a copy of Zero Hour so I could compare it to Airplane. Thanks to Autobud in Canada, I now have a copy. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I've been distracted by the zillion other things I've got to watch. But thank you very much for that copy of the film. Do appreciate it. I'm going to be in touch. We're going to work something out as a contra deal. But thank you very much. I also want to thank Shannon Marinko, who offered to get me a copy of it. And I had already had one. So thanks anyway, Shannon. Love your work. I love the possibilities of seeing what you're going to do next with your talent for silliness, absurdity, and having a media profile. Heard from Mark Pugh in Southampton, UK. Mark says, apologies about the Ashes so far, and if you care, that's a cricket reference. Downloaded the latest episode of your podcast, which I came across via the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema podcast. I'll have to listen to their podcast now if they're name-checking me. I've now downloaded all of them from iTunes and I'm still listening 7 hours later, and have so far spent £200 plus online as a result of your recommendations, especially the Eurospy book. Your podcast is excellent and informative, and wallet shrinking. Keep up the tremendous work. I really appreciate it, as I'm sure do countless others. Recommendation not necessarily for the podcast, but a great and very funny film with Dale and I. Never heard it covered by other sites, directed by Bruce Robinson, and very quotable. All the best, Mark. Thanks, Mark. I'm not sure With Nail and I is within the pre-1980 thing, but I have seen it once. I saw it under some weird circumstances when I wasn't really able to pay attention. I think some people in the same room I was watching it in were having an argument or something, so I'm going to have to revisit With Nail and I in a slightly more serene environment. And thank you for the recommendation. Please, people, recommend films to me. I may have already seen them. I may have seen them ages ago and forgotten about them, and I want to revisit them. Definitely do that. We want to make it interactive, and I'll pass on recommendations between you guys. I have been trying to find a format where everybody could chat together, but either my technological ineptitude or the state of the art isn't quite where I wanted to be, where we can all just hang out and have a chat. We'll have to do it through the podcast. But thank you very much for that. Oh, I'm going to make this podcast fairly short. I really didn't have a lot of time to prepare for it, and I do apologize for that, but I wanted to get my podcast out. And I do promise to have more preparation done next time. But I'm going to leave you with something that I found. It's a list of movies from a very fine speculative fiction writer, Lucius Shepard. I got it from his Live Journal page. So indulge me a little bit. I'm going to give you a list of movies, and I'm going to tell you what they all have in common. I might even put some music behind this because it's going to be a long and a little bit of a dull list. Arthur, John Carpenter's They Live, The Illustrated Man, The Crazies, Romancing the Stone, The Incredible Shrinking Man, When Worlds Collide, Fantastic Voyage, Meatballs, Back to School, Metropolis, The Dirty Dozen, Conan the Barbarian, Clash of the Titans, Akira, Death Wish, The Karate Kid, Footloose, The Thing, Red Dawn, Short Circuit, Fame, The Birds, Hellraiser, Poltergeist, Old Boy, Logan's Run, Child's Play, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Flash Gordon, Rosemary's Baby, The Jetsons, The Last Starfighter, Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, Forbidden Planet, Near Dark, Last Tango in Paris, Angel Heart, Red Sonja, Barbarella, The Host, My Fair Lady, Rashomon, All of Me, Captain Blood, Ten, Highlander, Brighton Rock, The Shadow, Knight Rider, The Evil Dead, Battle Royale, Fahrenheit 451, Tron, Westworld, A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Warriors, Piranha, Escape from New York, Porky's, Straw Dogs, The Lives of Others, 1984, Dune, The Swarm, and The Witches. So what do they all have in common? Riddle me that, Batman. I'll tell you. Hollywood's remaking them all. This kind of ties off the theme of the podcast, which is Hollywood is full of shit. They're remaking all those movies because they can't think of anything new and imaginative to spend the mega bucks on. They're looking for sure bet cash cows. They're not looking to make good films. They're looking to make successful films. And there is a difference. Have a look at the blockbusters of 5 or 6 years ago and work out whether you'd rewatch them or not. Those summer ones that everybody was lining up to see are as empty as a damp paper bag these days, because we've seen it all. We haven't got anything out of it. The juice has been squeezed out of it by only one viewing, which shows how thin the whole bloody thing is. We deserve better films, and we should be watching better films. I'm actively encouraging everyone to download the summer blockbusters on BitTorrent and choke these studios off their money cash flows for these things. Get them to spend money on quality things and then actually go out and see the quality ones. Buy the quality ones. The only DVDs I'm buying these days are the things that I think are really worthwhile. I bought the double box set of Watchmen Roast recently because I believe it's a much better film than a lot of the shit that's preceded it and has come subsequent to it as well. Yeah, I'm on a little bit of a rant. I think that one of the things about cinema is good movie makers don't cater to expectations. They exceed them. They create them. They don't just give people the same shit because they liked the same shit last year. They draw people towards better and brighter and more illuminating cinema. That's about it for this time around. Sorry if the sound quality is not as good. I did, as I said, had the microphone problems. But keep the emails coming. KULTGURU@gmail.com. poke me on Facebook if you want to. Have a chat to me on Twitter. It's Terry Frost, one word, lowercase. And I'll see you again in 3 weeks, hopefully with some more research done, but definitely with something different. And keep watching good movies in the meantime and enjoy them, or even really bad ones that are interesting. They can be a lot more fulfilling than the movies all your friends are going to see on a Saturday night. Okay, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.